Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled Food and Wine, Love and Death. This talk is delivered by Professor John Variano.
Welcome to tonight's lecture, which has been organized by Palazzo Falson. This lecture has been a long time in the making. 2 years ago, Professor Variano contacted me to say he was coming to Malta and to Indina, which he described as one of his favorite places on earth. And would I like him to give a lecture on a theme that he had recently published, that of food and art? Obviously, I leapt at the chance, and we quickly planned a seminar, but unfortunately, fate prevailed, and Professor Variano was not able to travel to Malta. Now his long-due visit has materialized, and true to his word, he has once again offered us a lecture. Tonight's lecture is special in more ways than one. Not only are we delighted to welcome such a distinguished academic speaking about a fascinating topic that interests us all, but we have, through the kindness of sponsors, been able to offer you a glass of Marsovine wine of the excellent 1919 range, made from grapes grown in Malta. And after the lecture, you will be able to sample food, which has been prepared by the acclaimed food writer and researcher, Matti Cremona. In preparing these dishes, Matti has stuck to the theme of food history and used ancient recipes dug up from archives. As you know, Palazzo Falson is not a for-profit organization. We strive to organize a number of activities and lectures which are, as far as we can manage it, completely free of charge, just like tonight's event. I think you will forgive us if we slip in a word or two to promote our services, which help to make the museum sustainable. The images you have just been seeing are of the museum's rooftop cafe, of Palazzo Falson at night, and of this very same palazzo, Palazzo Santa Sofia, with a dinner party setting. We do rent out the museum spaces for exclusive gatherings, such as private evening tours of the museum, dinner parties, book launches. If you are interested in making use of these services, please inquire with one of the Palazzo Falson team who are here tonight, or just drop us an email. You can also become a friend of the museum for a minimal fee, which is more than compensated by the list of benefits that you will be entitled to. There are some application forms at the back. Now, a few words about our distinguished speaker. John Variano is Professor Emeritus of Art History at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. After receiving his PhD from the University of Michigan, he has written 5 books and more than 50 articles on subjects that range from architecture in Baroque Italy to the literary myths of Rome, the realism of Caravaggio, and the history of gastronomy. His talk is derived from his most recent publications, Tastes and Temptations, Food and Art in Renaissance Italy, which was published in 2009, and Wine, A Cultural History, which was published a year later in 2010. Now I pass the word to you, John.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Francesca, and thank you, everyone who's turned out on such a raw night as this. Where I come from, this isn't really so bad. One of the motives for coming to Malta at this time of year was to escape winters in Massachusetts. But given the vagaries of recent climate, turns out the weather there is exactly the same as it is here. But I'm much happier to be here in this room. I don't think I've ever been in a room this old before to give a talk. And I apologize to anyone who was inconvenienced 2 years ago when illness prevented me from coming here. As Francesca said, my remarks this evening, can everyone hear all right? You can hear fine? Good. My remarks this evening are based on 2 books that I was engaged with in the last couple of years. And what you're going to get is a kind of tasting menu, if you will, from 2 of the chapters in one book and 2 of the chapters in the other book. The talk may not be as nuanced and as in as much detail as you might like. It could have been 4 talks, which I'm happy to give, But it's one talk which will try to do all the things that was listed on the handout. Did everyone receive a copy of the handout? There's really, it's a very coy title. I apologize for the coyness of the title. We're going to do some more serious things than this. One of the things we're going to begin talking about is the fact, as I'm sure most of you are aware, European art from the very beginning up until very recently has been about narration, narrative painting, works of sculptures as well, sometimes even buildings, that tell stories, that illustrate texts, the Bible being most common perhaps, classical mythology, contemporary histories, and so on. But I've always been intrigued with the fact that in looking at European art over the last 600 or 700 years, there often seems to be a little disingenuity that's visible between what the subject of a work might be, what it would appear if you only read the museum label, which I never recommend doing before you look at the picture, a little conflict between what the label says, what the painting purportedly represents, and what the artist's intention was. That content in works of art is not always the same thing as subject matter, and often artists can be quite self-indulgent in doing things within a text that satisfies the needs of the text, but often you suspect might just be a pretext for doing what the painter really wants to do anyway. And we could go on and on about that at great length. But since the subject initially tonight is love, most of which you're probably familiar, love and sacred art, so much of sacred art is about devotion and devotional love, we're going to talk more about profane art, and particularly what appears at the margins of profane art from the Renaissance through the 17th century. That's mainly what our itinerary will be. This will not be any kind of introduction to the history of art. If you haven't had an introduction to the history of art, I don't think this talk will probably be of a lot of use to you in learning about it. Because we're going to be looking at the margins, even with a picture like this, which was a grand scheme painted on the ceiling of the Villa Chigi in Rome, which is now, of course, known as the Farnesina, after it was taken over by the Farnese family. It was originally commissioned by the wealthiest man in Rome, Agostino Chigi, and decorated by Raphael and some of his assistants. You see the main ceiling in the Sala de Sique and the Farnesina that shows the loves of the gods and so forth. Another kind of somewhat frolicsome, maybe even frivolous scene, classical antiquity made palatable and made as agreeable as possible. If you look, however, in the margins of this picture where that red circle is located, you see there's some other things going on. Around the two main scenes is a great garland that surrounds it. Then there are other elements of decoration around it. And if you look more closely at what's inside that circle, you might be a little surprised. And this is where my talk begins this evening. There is a strong undercurrent of eroticism that runs through Italian Renaissance art, particularly in Rome. If you were going to take notes on any of this, you'd underline the word Rome. Rome is the most male of European cities, always has been, probably always will be, and quite a bit of witty play in visual arts and in poetry plays on the elusive properties of fruits and vegetables. Now, you see in that detail, what you think you see is in fact what you really see. And if we need an exegesis on this to confirm what it is we think we're seeing, 50 years after the painting was unveiled, Giorgio Vasari, the great biographer of Italian Renaissance painters, sculptors, and architects, wrote the following. Above the flying figure of Mercury, he fashioned a priapus from a gourd and two eggplants for testicles, while nearby he painted a cluster of large figs one of which, overripe and bursting open, is penetrated by the gourd. But why say more? Vasari didn't need to say more in 1568 about a picture that was made about 50 years earlier, because by this point it had really entered almost these marginal details, erotic details, had entered the mainstream of Italian, particularly Roman painting, even in some religious works. Now, the origins of this, and we're getting on grounds here that you have to really give some thought to. When we look at representations of sexual imagery in the pre-modern world, they do not always mean, in fact, I wonder if they ever mean, what we think they mean. That representations of fertility, as personified here in the god Priapus, is always, or very frequently, I should say, conjoined with fruits and vegetables and the bounty of the harvest. And what is missing in this fresco, of course, is the scale the Priapus holds, which balances the size of his mighty fertile phallus with a bag of gold. Now, this is a fertility emblem. This should not be misunderstood as an erotic play. There is erotic play in Pompeian frescoes, but this is not it. This is something that has a more different different kind of purpose. And this is a point of departure, perhaps, in the Renaissance. And when we begin to look at this kind of imagery that appears during the Roman Renaissance, we find it perhaps first appearing in literature before it appears in the visual arts. And we see that there's confraternities of artists. One of the most famous is the Accademia dei Vignuoli, the Academy of Vintners. And they would get together, usually during the harvest season, all male artists, of course, and they would eat and drink a great deal, and they would give names to one another, which always had erotic overtones. So it was Senior Radish, Senior Carrot, Senior Cardoon, things of that kind. And then they wrote these bawdy poems, and usually they're hymns to a particular fruit, which the peach was one of the favorite fruits to discuss. There are other fruits too. So Francesco Berni, in his Ode to the Peach, writes, "O fruit blessed above all others, good before, in the middle, and after the meal, but perfect behind." Now, what Berni's talking about there, and this is where the wit of language and visual imagery follows, he's using this word pesca as it was used in the 16th century, which was as a term of reference both to fishing and also a peach, and also a young man's bum. And then if you go through, this is John Fleur, this is the first Italian-English dictionary ever written by someone who was uniquely qualified to write it. He was born and raised in Italy, then migrated to France and learned, to England rather, and learned English perfectly. And we rely, I at least rely, on his translations from early Italian to get some sense of what they would have meant at the time. First edition of this is 1598. The title page you have before you is the second edition, 1611, wherein the expression dare le pesche is given as to give one's tail or to consent to unnatural sin. So I think we're getting the sense of how the interplay of language and visual arts intersect. This is a period, and we're still in the 16th century, the earlier parts of the 16th century, which really fetishized this portion of the male anatomy. And one of the most famous books that's been re-edited, reprinted, and translated many times is Antonio Vignali's book, La Cazzeria. And one finds appearing about the same time as the publication of this text is the emergence of images, of images that show fruit, peaches in particular, that are arranged in almost the same way, the cleft of the fruit corresponding to exactly the physiognomy of the male posterior anatomy. Now, the artist that comes to mind, I think, most prominently in this kind of imagery is the great Caravaggio, who everyone in Malta loves dearly. It was one of the great attractions for me to come to Malta in the first time to see these great late works by Caravaggio. This is an early work by Caravaggio. The only time I've seen it in Malta is on a reproduction in a pizzeria I happened to be in the night I arrived, which was only 2 days ago. It's Caravaggio's famous Bacchus, or his so-called Bacchus. Now, this is another wonderful example of what I meant by the disingenuity of old master painting. If you looked at the label of this, it would say Bacchus. You see, right, Bacchus is the god of wine, the god of pleasure, and so on. But if you start to look at the picture itself, you see that this young man is not any ordinary old man or young man. He has rather curious androgynous characteristics. There's reason, I can say as a footnote here, to suspect that it was modeled on a castrato singer who lived in the same palace that Caravaggio lived in Rome, in the 1590s. But he's dressed up in a kind of costume, a carnival costume of the leaves and the basket of fruit in the foreground, with painted with great accuracy. It's not a basket, but a bowl. The bowl of fruit is an exact replica of an actual 16th century Tuscan bowl known as a crespina, which is filled with fruit, which has always amazed the modern viewer, at least, who's accustomed to buying their fruit and vegetables in the supermarket after they've been sprayed with insecticide and perhaps wrapped in plastic, to see that there's so much decay in the fruit. There's so many blemishes and bruises and signs of insect predations and so forth, that this is not the ideal fruit by any means. But the decay of the fruit seems to match something of the depravity of the individual depicted. And as he's looking right out at you, with his left hand, he's offering you a glass of wine, while with his right hand, he's unfastening the sash around his waist. This is clearly for more an invitation to a wine tasting. There's something deeply erotic about this. The picture has been, in our lifetime, interpreted in a homoerotic way, but there have been subsequent discussions of just exactly who the audience was for this picture, or even who the audience still is for this picture. This is in Rome. We find that the same interplay, the allusion of fruits and vegetables with bounty on the one hand and with an erotic charge on the other hand, are found throughout Europe. This is a painting by the artist John Mueller, and it's in exactly the same subject. If you've seen this very beautiful poster that was made announcing this talk, this is a detail by an artist we hope to very soon identify. It's of Lot and his daughters. If you know the story of Lot and his daughters mistakenly believed that their father was the last man alive on earth, and that the only way that they could procreate was with their father, who didn't seem too keen on the idea, and so they plied him with wine. And then in a straight of drunkenness, not realizing who he was with or what he was doing, he then had intercourse with his daughters. Now, Jan Mueller is a very discreet painter here. He's not showing the nudity of these daughters very much. In fact, they're quite covered up, and it's otherwise a fairly prudish painting. But the sexuality of the daughter in the foreground is most clearly indicated by the fact that her right arm rather languidly drips down into this basket of fruit, and her middle finger seems to be playing with one of the fruits. This is a commonplace in the margins of European art. And the last works of the series I'll show you is a picture that I came across not so long ago. If anyone has seen this painting in recent years, I'd love to know where you saw it. It appeared on the Naples art market back in the early part of this decade, attributed to a close and rather loyal follower of Caravaggio, Bartolomeo Manfredi, boy giving the fig gesture. The boy holds rather firmly in his right hand the basket of fruit, while with his left hand he performs this gesture, which is first mentioned in Dante. It has a long literary tradition as well as visual tradition, the fig gesture. Now, I don't know, I don't live in the southern Mediterranean, if this is a gesture one ever encounters anymore. Well, it's a very rude gesture, and I don't suggest that you do it if you, next time you're caught in a traffic jam or somebody swipes your parking space. But the point is that this combination of the sexual innuendo and the basket of fruit is really pretty evident. Are these the Maltese censors coming to shut us down? Yeah. Okay. So let's change the topic to what will seem like a much more serious topic. It still involves love, a certain amount of eroticism, but with emphasis much more on diet and the dietary effects of the foods one eats. And this takes us from a clerical world of Rome. Certainly many of these puns, the literary poems and so forth, were directed against the clergy. A lot of fun poked at the clergy in 16th century Rome. But we're going now a northward journey to two places, first Cremona and then to Bologna, northern cities which have always had great reputations for eating. Indeed, the very identity of the city of Bologna is based on its gastronomic superiority, and they feel at least, to the rest of Italy. And here we find something really quite different from what we've just been looking at. If that what we just saw was a little rich for your taste, this might find more palatable. The first of these pictures is by the Cremonese artist, Vincenzo Campi, who lived on to 1591. Campi is not an artist who received the kind of commissions that were documented and certified for time to come, which make the life of an art historian easy, because we can read the contracts in the archives, we can see the dates, we can see the signatures, and we know who commissioned the work, when they commissioned it, and how much the artist was paid. Works of this kind, the kind of genre paintings that we find, admittedly in the margins, although often sparked with some allegorical overlay so as to justify in the minds of collectors, patrons, and maybe the artists themselves, that there is some erudition evident in such a picture. Now, you're looking to say, where's the erudition? I don't see anything that looks particularly erudite. Well, this painting tells a story. And the story may not be immediately obvious, and it's not like other stories and narratives that you see in Italian Renaissance art. It's a story that actually has two parts to it. And the first part is the part on the right, and it might be an example of a picture that one reads from right to left, which is somewhat contrary to the way we normally read pictures. On the right side of this painting, we see this fair maiden, very demure looking, who's emptying great buckets of seafood onto a counter, which is presumably a sales counter, and it's got all kinds of yummy fish, shellfish, crabs, and so forth. Wonderful fish here in the foreground breaking over the edge of the frame. And then a pot which looks like it might be a big zuppa di pesce that's underway. This is all about fish, right? But then look at the other side of the picture, starting with the center of the picture, which is this dog who's often, not always, but often the sign of the unbridled appetite. And what we have on the left side of the picture is really quite different. Two peasants and their child who are having lunch of some kind, and they are not eating the fish that are being sold or presumably at the counter at which they're working. They're eating something quite different from this. Mainly, they seem to be eating beans. This utterly uncouth individual slurping beans out of a bowl. His sort of not too bright wife sort of looking on admiringly, and their decidedly not very bright child sitting there making a bit of a fuss. That's not the only thing that's being consumed is beans. There is also bread, cheese, and walnuts. And I understand some of the things on the menu are cheese and walnuts. Everything I'm talking about is pseudoscience. None of it is true, okay? So have no fears that if you eat beans, they're lowly, filling the head with gross humors and bringing on bad dreams, while cheese is totally harmful to the phlegmatic, difficult to digest, of little nutriment, not good for the stomach, and produces bile, gout, pleurisy, and stones. This is taken from any of you who've been looking at early recipe books, many of which have been reprinted in recent times. This is from the first important recipe book of the Italian Renaissance, Bartolo Sacchi's book, De Onesta Voluptate, translated as On Right Pleasure and Good Health, from 1470. And this is, in many ways, a summary of earlier recipes that have been floating around in Italy up to this time. But he writes and he publishes this book. It goes through numerous editions. It's read by everyone. Leonardo da Vinci had a copy of this in his library, and he praised its author, who's also known as Plotina, by the way. His true name, Bartolomeo Sacchi. Now, what Sacchi is getting at here is something that runs through the course of culinary manuals throughout the Renaissance and sometimes really up almost to the 19th century, surprisingly so. And what that is, when he talks about gross humors in the second line, and then he talks about the phlegmatic individual in the fourth line, what he's referring to, and somebody's head is slightly in the way, is the belief, the longest lasting, most enduring medical belief in the history of humankind is the belief that the four humors, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, control the well-being of every human. But to be in good health is to have those four humors in balance. And according to humoral theory, and the place, if you want to read about humoral theory to begin, is Hippocrates. He has a whole book on humoral theory that when the humors are in balance, you feel fine. If the humors are out of balance, you don't feel so good. If the humors are out of balance, there are a few things you can do about it. You can starve yourself, or you can ingest certain foods and certain beverages to rebalance the imbalance in your humors. And everyone believes this up until the 19th century, really long after what we think of as modern medical discoveries were made in the 17th and 18th centuries. The theory of the humors totally discredited. I don't think anybody still believes in the humors today. Hope not. But this really guides a lot of the eating practices of people in the period, eating and drinking practices in the period, because foods and drinks both, are also hot and wet or moist and dry. And so in hospitals, for instance, in the Renaissance, when the records are preserved, and I found some of these, patients in hospitals in the Renaissance Florence were given a choice of, or rather the physician was given a choice of five different wines to have with their meal. They weren't being pampered to as patients. This wasn't like some luxury hotel, but the physician was prescribing the wines, dry white, sweet white, dry red, sweet red, in accordance to their humoral needs, their purported humoral needs. And that's where this business is coming from, the gross humors and the phlegmatic. And if you read through Plotiner or Scoppy's book, you'll see almost every foodstuff in the book will have its humoral qualities appended to the discussion. People with gallstones shouldn't eat this. People who have fertility problems should have that, and so forth and so on. It makes interesting reading. Now, one of the main texts that emphasize this idea, basically, that you are what you eat. And I think some nutritionists would say even today, you are what you eat. If your idea of a meal is to go to McDonald's on Republic Street and have a double burger with extra fries, or if your choice of lunch is to have a nice arugula salad with fresh squeezed lemon on it, you're making a life choice. You're making a decision there which will have implications for your condition of your later heart. Now, this book by Baldassare Pisanelli, first edition, 1585, numerous subsequent editions, this is a later edition we're looking at here. Pisanelli talks about this. He emphasizes the social consequences of diet, claiming that, quote, some foods are intrinsically better suited for noble or delicate people, and others for farmers or those who work with their hands. And what we encounter here in 1585 with Pisanelli, and there are other places that do this as well, is the notion of a distinction being made between people who live in the cities and people who live on farms in the country. It's a snobbish social distinction to make, and the foodstuff that people in the country like to eat are usually vilified in texts like Pisanelli. So you find, here's another painting by Vincenzo Campi of the poultry sellers. Every imaginable kind of creature is in this picture. And Pisanelli writes, birds that fly through the air, the lightest of elements, are nutritionally sound for those who have no profession and who attend to their studies and to contemplation. People like us, in other words. So, you know, eat birds, eat fish, don't eat beef. And I'm sure you're reading this, if you read Health and Americans, are obsessed by what they eat and what they shouldn't eat, even though they're all obese to begin with. This becomes a problem. What you really shouldn't eat are all the things that are represented in Passerotti's painting of the butcher shop. Now, Passerotti is a virtual contemporary of Conti. He died a year later in 1592, and he is from Bologna, the city that has always prided itself on its culinary distinction. And here we have the sense that you are the customer standing at the counter in a Bolognese shop, and these guys are pointing out the really good cuts of beef, and would you like to sample the cinghiale? We have a wonderful wild boar that just was brought in, and all this meat is hanging on the racks behind. Now, the consequences of this kind of diet, let's say you do buy all this stuff and you eat it, according to people who follow Pisanelli's regimen, is you will end up like this. And this character on the right is, of course, the same person who's just working in that butcher shop, and he's out for a night in a town with some of his companions, one of whom is dressed up like Bacchus, wears the same costume virtually as we saw in the Caravaggio a bit earlier, and he's got the laurel wreath in his head, and their manners are so appallingly bad that even a dog is allowed to stand on the table and look what they're eating, pork leg, garlic, figs, bread, and red wine, and this person cradling that container of wine as if it's the most important thing of all. This is where bad eating habits can take you. The Pisanelli and Passerotti would agree. The one painter who seems to transcend this a bit, and the author of one of the most intriguing paintings of the late 16th century, is Annibale Carracci, an artist who really does transcend his time in a way that Campi and Passerotti do not, an artist who really laid down a legacy for painting They went right through the academic tradition of painting in the 20th century. But before Annibale turned to those kinds of classicizing pursuits, before he turned to classicizing pursuits and we associate mainly with his paintings in Rome, back in Bologna in his early years, in the 1580s, he did a small number of pictures about people doing what Bolognese people like to do best, which is eating. In this case, it's a peasant, it's a villino, somebody from out in the country, eating beans, of course. And in front of him, next to the beans, are scallions. And in front of that is something that modern recipe makers have followed. It's quite easy to follow the recipes for this torta di bietola, or charred pie. If you like quiche, you'd love the charred pie. That's right in the foreground. This is a specialty of Bologna at this time. It appears in all Bolognese cookbooks, recipe books, menus, and so forth. And then, of course, you have some bread and some red wine, which I've always found somewhat disjunctive with the picture in that the wine is in a stemmed glass. You'll notice that in other pictures of this type, including some we just looked at, like the Passerotti, it's in a beaker. And this is a stemmed glass, which would suggest a degree of refinement, which is otherwise invisible in this picture, with this person with such terrible manners. Now, what we're looking at in a meal like this, according to our friend Pisanelli, should not be eaten except by those who labor hard. The scallions, quote, serve no other purpose than to excite the libido while increasing one's readiness for coitus and producing notable increase in sperm. That's the last word. Better to cover it up, right? Okay. Now, what Pisanelli writes was republished, and one of the things that I found really fascinating about the early modern period is to look carefully at the bibliographical appearance of printings, editions, and translations, which is the way you have an idea. Maybe now you can get the idea going to Amazon.com of how many copies of a book and where book sales have been ranked. It's very disagreeable and disheartening effort for people who have actually written books, because I'm ranked like 16,822. But Juan Huarte would have been ranked at the very highest levels of readership among people who could read in the 16th century. 70 editions in six languages printed between the principal, the initial edition, in 1575 and the year 1700. This book was widely read. It was purchased by people in every European country and widely read. And it's interesting, in many of the copies that survive, you see the kinds of stains on it and so forth that would come with someone eating their pasta dish while leafing through the pages. Now, there's an Italian edition that follows the original Spanish, and very shortly thereafter, the English edition of the Examination of Men's Wits. Now, where this goes is a very dangerous and deterministic place, and this is nonsense, but I think it's very amusing nonsense nevertheless. Huarte talks about cow's flesh, beef, bread of dark grain, cheese, olives, will breed a gross seed of faulty temperature, back to the humors again, and the child so engendered shall have the strength of a bull, but be furious and of a beastly intelligence. So we've gone past the stage of some of the early examples that we looked at of you eat bad food and you don't feel well and you have cardiac arrest at the age of 45. Now we're talking about something else. We're talking about the begetting of stupid children by people who are themselves already stupid. So this is continuing a line of thinking. So, you know, eat well if you can. Other examples, and here's one you can see is clearly derived from Huarte. This is an Italian 1600 publication. Says almost the same thing, doesn't it? Beans, dark bread, meats, dark wine, make semen gross, bad temperament. The son that is generated will have the force of a bull. There'll be wild, a bestial temper. That's almost literally lifted from Huarte. It turns out it's a miracle if one has acute intelligence or is apt for learning, particularly where such rough foods are consumed. This is why they are born slow and rough from having been generated through such foods. The contrary is true of city folks, he's saying proudly, whose sons have more intellect and ability. This was really widely understood at this time. And when you look at food paintings of this period, admittedly in the margins of Italian painting, you'll see these more frequently than you might imagine. Now, if you go back to Carracci's Bean Eater again, I'd like to start the third section of this little talk. And this has to do with wine, which has been represented in several of these paintings, but wine, which is employed as a metaphor and as an emblem of something really quite different, as a memento mori, as a reminder of death. Something gives you pause, and you see a glass of wine, you're holding one in your hand, you think about it, and you think about yourself. And where this begins, that wine can be considered as being aligned with death, goes back to very ancient times. It has a lineage that Herodotus actually attributes to the ancient Greeks who were centuries before him. And if, according to Herodotus, it was in ancient Egypt that wooden corpses carved and painted to resemble nature as nearly as possible were passed among dinner guests with the exhortation to gaze here and drink and be merry, for when you die, such will be you. Now, I mean, it sounds a bit lugubrious if someone passed a little wooden doll around tonight and said, eat and drink because, you know, you're going to die someday, and nothing will be left. These people did not seriously believe in an afterlife. If they did believe in an afterlife, they didn't take it terribly seriously. There's quite a bit of literature, condensed here rather quickly for you, that has the same attitude of what I think today we call carpe diem, seize the day, seize the opportunity, live well while you still can. Enjoy your time, my soul. Another race will shortly fill the world and take your place, but think not of it. Drink the racy wine, rich Tagetes, pressed from the vine. Drink it and cheer your heart and banish care. A load of wine will lighten your despair. So be merry. This is 6th century before Christ. And if you go to ancient cemeteries, and this is my absolutely favorite cemetery in ancient Greece, the Kerameitos Cemetery in Athens, and you look at tombstones and the epigraphy that appears on tombstones, you see surprisingly frequent recurrences of this very same theme. Here are a few that a colleague of mine in classics department translated for me. Drink and eat and wear flowers, suddenly we are dead. Drink, you see the end while you live, drink. The man was a satisfactory follower of the muses and an agreeable fellow over his cups. Bacchus was always my friend. These appear with some regularity in Greek tomb inscriptions. The person who gets the most credit for this philosophy of life, perhaps undeservedly so, is the poet Horace, who wrote in these famous lines, which you probably don't read in grammar school, be smart, drink your wine, scale back your long hopes to a short period, even as we speak, envious time is running away from us. Seize the day, carpe diem, seize the day, trusting little in the future. Now, in the world of visual arts, there's very similar expressions of this appear as early as some of the 2nd century before Christ. This is a quite famous, frequently reproduced image of a Pompeian mosaic now in the museum in Naples. It's a floor mosaic, and it shows a skeleton who is waiting on your table, bringing not one but two jugs of wine to the table to serve. And this is interesting, if you're following the history of wine at all, is that in ancient Greece and Rome, and really up until the modern time, no one drank pure wine. It was always diluted with water. And the recipes go back to ancient Greece that discuss the relative proportions of wine with water. By all rights, the skeleton should be carrying a bottle of water, but he's not. He's carrying two bottles of wine with him to the table to induce you to satisfy that appetite. Now, there's a type of object which is extremely rare. Its survival is extremely rare. Until last Thursday, I knew there was only five in existence. And then on Thursday, thanks to the wonders of the internet, I found the sixth object. It's known as a larva convivialis. And it's exactly the, this is a small object. I know it looks like a reproduction of a Giacometti sculpture, but it's a small object that would fit on your keychain. And it's jointed. You might see here there are little joints for the arms and the legs and so forth. And it seems to be the kind of object that Petronius is actually talking about in his Satyricon, the famous dinner party that is given. A slave presented the dinner guests with a skeleton made of silver, no less, made in such a way that the bones and joints could be turned in any direction. And this is passed around among the diners with the exhortation to eat and drink more, because who knows what tomorrow will bring. Excuse me. This is a famous dinner party of Trimalchio, which has sometimes been restaged. This object turned up in a museum in Russia. I just came across this. This would be number six of the surviving objects of this type. There's one I know in Rome. There's one at the Getty Museum. Now, other objects which also celebrate this very same theme can themselves be very precious objects that are used for the imbibing of the wine itself. We know that ancient Greeks, of course, used ceramic ware, often decorated with wonderful Dionysian scenes. Romans never painted their earthenware. They turned to silver and glass, and we find in both silver and glass goblets of the Roman period images. This is the finest example I know in the Louvre of a goblet, a good-sized cup, that shows a parade of skeletons dancing, playing music, and generally carousing. And this cup was dug up in the Vesuvius region, a place called Bosco Reale. I can't help but look at this and think at the same time of someone drinking wine from this cup when the first rumblings of Vesuvius were heard in the distance in 79 AD. I mean, that's a lot to contemplate. One of really favorite objects, and sort of condensing a lot of things here, the most poignant objects, is this tomb, a Roman tomb of a man by the name of Flavius Agricola, which was discovered quite by accident, unhappy accident, when excavations were being made in the year 1626 for Bernini's baldachin at the crossing of the new St. Peter's. And I think the Pope and everyone involved was hoping, in this age where martyrdom was a great cult, and a cult of relics was developing rapidly in the face of Protestant reformers, would have hoped that what they would find in the sub-crypt of St. Peter's would be the bones or some relic of St. Peter himself. Wouldn't that have been nice? And wouldn't this have been a disappointment? Because this sculpture, which we now see only the effigy lying down with a cup of wine in one hand, he seems to be adjusting a wreath of ivy on his head, was accompanied originally by an inscription. And this is the inscription. Friends who read this, I advise you, mix up the wine and drink far away. Wrap your brow with flowers and do not resist the pleasures of intercourse with pretty girls. All the rest after death is nothing. Now, this guy is a real Epicurean, and Epicurean philosophy And if any of you have read Lucretius's on the order of things, understand that this is a period which put the enjoyment of life, or rather hedonistic enjoyment of life, above all other pursuits. And Flavius, who was absolutely doing this himself, when Pope Urban VIII saw this inscription, he had it destroyed, and he threatened, under pains of excommunication, anyone who copied or repeated that inscription. But it was inscribed, and that actually is something that's passed along. The sculpture itself was quietly whisked away from the Vatican, ended up in the garden of a papal nephew in Rome, and then through a series of ownership changes that I don't quite understand, it's now in the Indianapolis Museum of Art in Indiana. Now, the last part of this talk has to do with the memento mori, but a very different meaning to memento mori. If memento mori in the ancient world basically was a reminder of death, live your life as fully and as richly as you possibly can while you're still alive. The Middle Ages, of course, had very little to do with it, very little recorded, I should say, to say on this subject. But the subject of wine and death reappears in the later Renaissance. And it reappears in a type of work that comes into existence right at the time of the Protestant Reformation, when iconoclastic pressures in Northern Europe are making religious narrative undesirable, still continues somewhat, but where iconoclasts are destroying works of narrative art and disbelieving in saints and all the intermediaries of the Catholic Church, there comes about a group of pictures that fall into a category of allegory, where moral and ethical values are embedded in everyday, what purportedly are everyday objects. It can be landscape, or it can most frequently be in still life. And the category of still life that comes into existence at this time is known as the vanitas, the vanity, which has marvelous biblical pedigree, going back vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And this subject was attached to Netherlandish still life painting, which has imagery in it, most obviously of a skull and of human death, but then sometimes secondary imagery, an extinguished candle, or objects like the hourglass, or here perhaps even you may notice, it looks like a speck on your slide, a fly has alighted on the skull, and the fly, of course, is an emblem of transience and the passage of time. It didn't take very long before the imagery in the Northern European vanitas became a little more sophisticated than this. This is a bit blunt. It's awfully, awfully explicit. What we begin to see as you get certainly into the 17th century, following Calvinist ideals and neo-stoical ideals, that one should look at the objects in one's life, assuming you're a prosperous merchant in Amsterdam and you've collected fine silver, and you've collected many of the beautiful objects that you see in Palazzo Falzon today, for example, that a lot of guilt comes along with this, a terrible embarrassment of riches. And if you're interested in this subject, there's an absolutely terrific book by Simon Schama called The Embarrassment of Riches, and it has to do with the tremendous guilt that especially Dutch people who were very wealthy in the 17th century felt about their material possessions. And then a whole class of pictures emerges out of that simple vanitas type with the skull and extinguished candles that feature luxury goods, either pewter, this is probably silver, fruits that are objects that have been imported, porcelains that come from China, and so forth, some very fine work here. But in all of these pictures by Peter Kleist, at least, including this sign, this monogrammed and dated picture of 1647, the dominant feature, and repeated through his paintings, is a large glass goblet of white wine. And that is known as a roemer, R-O-E-M-E-R, and these things still exist. They're mighty big. When you see a roemer, it will take two hands to clasp around that object, especially when it's full of wine. And this stands up really kind of like a sentinel in this picture, getting your attention, focusing your attention on a picture which is otherwise about loss and about disappointment. The way the tablecloth has been disarrayed, the way things have been turned over, the beautiful pheasant lying on that plate hasn't even started yet. It's as if something very sudden and very unexpected has happened to the person who was enjoying this meal. What remains here as an emblem for viewers at the time to see was that large goblet of wine. Now, some of these goblets of wine still survive, and some of them bear inscriptions. This is a lovely example, dated just a couple of years after the painting by Claude, so that you now see the detail, which has a poem on it, which I had a Dutch friend translate for me. It says, nota bene, please look carefully. Look, this wine taken with a plan brought joy to many a man, but if one indulges too much, wrong wine creates sorrow as such. This is a real downer. This is not carpe diem. This is, you know, you should be thinking about more important things. And the image that I really like to end with is an image that has great resonance, I think, then and now. It's an image that combines a probably familiar scene of the 17th century, and in fact, somewhat familiar scenes on the street of Valletta in the last couple of nights, the carnival. People in costumes going out, and I must say, very well-behaved children in Valletta. This is not Mardi Gras in New Orleans, or, you know, people losing their self-control in Venice or Rio. But here in Holland, Judith Leister, one of the most important women painters of the period, paints two carnival revelers who one has clearly emptied his jug of wine. He's showing the viewer that there's nothing more to drink while he's holding his tobacco pipe up in the air. So it's sort of the poster boy of bad behavior. And his companion here is just slugging back a great big jug of beer. And at their side, there appears a skeleton who holds a skull of his own, which is a clever conceit. But he also holds in his hand a candle which is burning out, is about to be extinguished. And it's like he's tugging on the sleeve of this drinker, like, and of course shaking an hourglass in his face virtually, that you're going down the wrong path, Buster. You should really be thinking about your soul and your spirit and not to indulge in this way. Now, Leister and many other Dutch painters of this period painted pictures that generally call merry companies. We even saw the Passerotti, which is given this title, merry company. People having a good time, often playing music, singing, and drinking a lot. But this picture by Leister has a really very special bite to it because it's the combination of this hedonistic pleasure with the reminder of death. This is something that seems to haunt the northern imagination. Be grateful you're from the south where people don't have this kind of guilt-ridden sense. But one of the popular types of imagery in the late Renaissance in northern Europe was the print. The print, of course, is a wonderful outgrowth of the printing press and books. It was a wonderful corollary of printed texts, and artists then could reproduce images at very little cost, of course. And there are a number of these series called The Dance of Death. This is a number of prints by Holbein. This shows a young married couple who's walking out perhaps to their wedding feast, and they're joined by a skeleton who stands in their path beating a drum. And it's this idea, the joylessness of it, that is taken over by Leister. Now, the fact that this picture still has some resonance, I think, is evident. Here's one more image of this type of thing. This is a image with a poem translated, "Oe, oe, surprise, surrender, you beasts. Do you never make an end to your Bacchic feasts? Your merriment will be cut short. Your joy will become confined to an eternity of hellish crying. Oof. I mean, that really is a downer. But the fact that this picture continued to move people is evident in this remarkable comparison, which shows the before and after. Some collector, I suspect probably in the 19th century, liked the painting all but for that skeleton, and very cleverly painted the skeleton out, got rid of the hourglass, replaced the leg of the skeleton with the leg of a table, left the candle in exactly the same place, and just removed that bit of iconography from the painting. And no one knew before 1993 that the skeleton was there. And when the picture was cleaned for an exhibition and looked at with an x-ray, that was finally discovered. So what we've seen here, all briefly, is this sense of wine and the bringing of truth, and that this notion, which is so frequently used, of wine brings truth, in vino veritas, Pliny talks about this all the time, which is a social truth. You might disclose some things to a friend or to an associate you would never disclose. You might be indiscreet in a way you would never be indiscreet before you had that second glass of wine. On the one hand, the social truth, but on the other hand, I mean, what we're seeing in some in vino veritas pictures, especially the more recent post-Reformation ones, is that wine, it really is a fluid truth, and it can be a matter of life and of death. Thank you.
Enjoyable.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled Food and Wine, Love and Death. This talk was delivered by Professor John Variano.